Good morning, and welcome to our weekly series for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Primary Care Curriculum Didactic. My name is Ananth Shenoy. I'm an outpatient internist, and I'm joined today by one of your illustrious faculty, Dr. Michelle Lamb.
Good morning, everyone.
Well, thank you for joining us, Dr. Lamb. I understand that we are going to be talking about bariatric surgery today, which given the tidal wave of obesity that we are dealing with and that we are seeing, this is going to be very relevant for our day-to-day practice. Just as a quick disclaimer and a reminder to everyone listening, we will be discussing patient cases, but they are all fictional and there's no protected health information. And of course, you can find the full didactic on the G Drive. And of course, the fact that you're listening to this podcast knows you know how to find the podcast. So with that, Dr. Lamb, is there anything you want us to know before we kind of dive into the cases?
You know, I think a lot of patients have had some sort of bariatric surgery or are thinking about it. And so I think hopefully this didactic is helpful for kind of teasing apart the different types of bariatric surgery and what we as primary care doctors should be looking at when we're seeing these patients.
Yes, indeed. I think this is a very high yield topic and something we see very, very frequently. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular background points that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so just some basic background. You know, more than 40% of U.S. adults have obesity, which is expected to rise over the next couple of decades. Obesity is a chronic disease, so like diabetes or hypertension, that requires long-term management and treatment. We still define obesity often by BMI, which is a screening tool that correlates reasonably well with a high body fat, but there is considerable variability, especially in the overweight range, and there has definitely been a push to move away from BMI and consider other metrics such as waist circumference, which has been more strongly associated with greater risk for cardiometabolic disease. However, unfortunately, like insurance companies still use BMI cutoffs often to determine eligibility for anti-obesity medications and bariatric surgery. So many of you might be familiar with the different cutoffs that we use for defining weight according to BMI. So underweight is usually a BMI less than 18.5. Healthy weight is defined by a BMI 18.5 to less than 25. Overweight is a BMI 25 to less than 30. And then for obesity, that is broken down by different classes. So class 1 obesity is a BMI of 30 to 35. Class 2 is a BMI of 35 to 40. And then class 3 is a BMI above 40. Just a quick note for Asian and South Asian populations, there are lower BMI cutoffs actually because their pattern of adiposity with central obesity raises a risk of multiple comorbidities, usually at a lower BMI compared with other populations. So overweight for Asian and South Asian populations is a BMI of 23 to 25, and obesity is defined as a BMI greater than 25. And then interestingly, regarding bariatric surgery, according to the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, the amount of cases for bariatric surgery had increased steadily over the past decade. However, for 2023 and 2024, they actually showed a reversal in terms of a volume decrease, which they think likely is due to GLP-1 agonist prescribing. Only 1% of those eligible to undergo bariatric surgery receive it, and there's numerous reasons I think for that. However, bariatric surgery has been shown to be the most effective and longest lasting treatment, especially for severe obesity or the class 3 obesity. The bariatric surgery provides more significant and sustained weight loss often compared to GLP-1 drugs. And then there's also just a greater risk of relapse and weight regain with the anti-obesity medications compared to post-bariatric surgery.
That's a really helpful background and kind of staggering how few of our patients who are eligible for bariatric surgery are able to receive it.
Yeah.
Particularly given that it is such an efficacious treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I think we also, as usual, we have our health equity spotlight to talk about disparities in care. And are you aware of any disparities within the bariatric surgery?
Yeah, so there's a lot. I think another reason why, you know, not as many people receive bariatric surgery as who qualify for it. So utilization rates, non-Hispanic Black patients are less likely to undergo bariatric surgery compared to non-Hispanic white and Hispanic patients, and specifically African-American men, are significantly underrepresented among bariatric surgery patients. In terms of also post-operative outcomes, Black patients have higher rates of 30-day mortality, readmissions, and complications compared to white patients, and they also have worse outcomes compared to Hispanic patients as well. And then just in terms of access to care. So patients with lower socioeconomic status, including those with Medicaid or without insurance, are less likely to undergo bariatric surgery, probably likely due to cost of the procedure. The Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion did improve some access for low-income patients, I guess to be determined what happens with that in the near future with some of the cuts to Medicaid, however. And I found this interesting study actually that was looking more at the qualitative reasons, sort of why the socioeconomic barriers contribute to, this was actually looking at patients after bariatric surgery and experiencing less weight loss compared for lower socioeconomic patients versus higher socioeconomic patients. And there were kind of five main themes that they determined, which were like limited health literacy, so challenging employment situations, people are often working multiple jobs, limited income, unreliable transportation, and like unsafe or inconvenient neighborhoods. And all of these factors kind of affected a patient's ability to afford and access healthy foods and adhere to physical activity recommendations and take supplements and vitamins after bariatric surgery.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lam. I think that's a really important call out and spotlight. Mm-hmm. We're going to transition to talk about cases, and you'll walk us through some of the medicine that we in particular are going to be responsible for as internists. Mm-hmm. So our first case that we have for you, so Mr. Z is a 58-year-old with a history of class 3 obesity, so that very elevated BMI, type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and osteoarthritis of their knees. They have a body mass index of 44.9, and they tell you that they have struggled with their weight for decades, which is a very common story for many of our patients. Mm-hmm. They've also, this patient has had many unsuccessful attempts at losing weight with diet and exercise. Again, very common with our patients. Recently, he was able to lose 18 pounds after starting liraglutide for his diabetes, but unfortunately, his weight loss has plateaued. Now, his medications include metformin, the liraglutide that was mentioned, chlorthalidone, amlodipine, and atorvastatin. It's like our favorite cocktail, right? He unfortunately smokes 6 cigarettes a day. On his exam, his blood pressure is elevated at 150 over 80, and he has central obesity with a waist circumference of 42 inches. His labs are significant for an A1C above goal at 7.8, but a normal TSH. And he is actually considering bariatric surgery and wants to get your thoughts as his physician on this. So my first question for you, does this patient qualify for bariatric surgery? And maybe tell us about if or why not, and then review some guidelines.
Yeah. So there are selection criteria that were developed way back in 1991, and sadly, they are still being used to determine eligibility for bariatric surgery in the U.S. So those criteria are mainly that you either have a BMI greater than 40, so that class 3 obesity, or a BMI greater than 35, the class 2 obesity, with at least one obesity-related comorbidity, like type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, MASLD, GERD, stress incontinence, or osteoarthritis. Most payers and insurance companies also have additional requirements, including participation in a weight loss program for a specific period, which is often 6 months, or even sometimes preoperative weight loss. The practice of insurance-mandated preoperative weight loss is quite controversial and has been challenged by larger governing bodies as potentially harmful, unethical, and not supported by scientific data. But just know that if a patient wants to get bariatric surgery, there often is a little bit of a lead-in time where they have to potentially meet with a nutritionist or participate in a weight loss program beforehand, mandated by the insurance companies. In terms of an evidence update, so in 2022, the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, again, came up with some new guidelines. However, the insurance companies have not applied these criteria yet. Hopefully they will. But the new indications for bariatric surgery are for patients who have a body mass index greater than 35, regardless of whether they have other comorbidities. Also should be considered for patients who have a BMI of 30 to 35, so that class 1 obesity category. And they also included a statement about BMI threshold should be adjusted in the Asian population such that a BMI greater than 25, where we are defining obesity, should be clinical obesity, and those with an even higher BMI of 27.5 should be offered metabolic bariatric surgery. So in this case, Mr. Z definitely qualifies for bariatric surgery given his BMI is greater than 40. He also has many weight-related comorbidities, including diabetes, sleep apnea, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and knee osteoarthritis. However, he is also actively smoking, so you can help him by working on smoking cessation, as active smoking would preclude him from getting a bariatric surgery at this point, and that is just due to increased risk of many post-operative complications like marginal ulcers, venous thromboembolic events, and slowed wound healing. As his PCP, you can optimize his blood pressure and really blood sugar control as well.
Thank you, Dr. Lam. That is a really helpful review. And I will say in my practice, I found this as a helpful motivating factor to come off of cigarettes because, again, usually they really want to get this surgery or any surgery and then helps add to that motivation. So we've talked about the qualifying criteria. What are some of the contraindications to bariatric surgery?
Yeah, so contraindications, generally the things that you think about when you're thinking about like preoperative surgery planning for a patient. So contraindications include, you know, any congestive heart failure, unstable coronary artery disease, any like bad end stage lung disease, active cancer, cirrhosis with portal hypertension, or any drug alcohol dependency, including active smoking. Crohn's disease is also a contraindication, and then any current or planned pregnancy as well in the next like 1 to 2 years is also on contraindication. So, and I think the main things for setting expectations too for patients is that they need to understand that bariatric surgery requires patients to make, you know, big lifestyle changes and radical changes in their eating, sort of lifelong monitoring and vitamin replacement. And so we should be setting that expectation and then also carefully assessing for any, you know, mental health needs like untreated depression or psychosis, binge eating disorders, and again, any drug or alcohol abuse. So the smoking cessation is preferred for at least 6 weeks prior to surgery, preferably for a year, as again, smokers are at higher risk for short-term and long-term morbidity after bariatric surgery.
That's really good to know. And most of those would be contraindications to any elective surgery, of course. My next question for you is, what are the kind of the most common types of bariatric surgery? And then how effective are the different common ones and how safe are they?
Yeah, there's basically two main types of bariatric surgery. One is the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which we often call gastric bypass. It accounts for 30% of all bariatric surgeries. In this, the stomach is divided into two portions, the upper and the lower stomach pouches. And the upper stomach pouch becomes like a very small pouch to the size of an egg. And the lower stomach segment basically just is bypassed and no longer digests or hold food. The small intestine is then divided and the distal limb of the jejunum is attached to the new stomach pouch. And so the distal jejunum is now receiving contents directly from the new stomach pouch. Bypassed lower stomach portion and duodenum segment are connected to the lower aspect of the limb, creating a Y shape. So that's why we call it a Roux-en-Y. As a result of this procedure, there's faster delivery of nutrients to the small bowel and a decreased gastric capacity. The decreased transit time in the small bowel results in decreased micronutrient absorption. And as you may recall, the duodenum and stomach are responsible for absorption of fat and fat-soluble vitamins. And so when we bypass these segments with this procedure, that can lead to vitamin deficiencies. Interestingly, bypassing the stomach also leads to increased production of GLP-1, which also helps to contribute to weight loss. And the average weight loss at 1 year after this procedure is about 30 to 35%. So fairly significant. The other type of bariatric surgery is a sleeve gastrectomy, or sometimes called a vertical sleeve gastrectomy. And this actually accounts for 60% of all bariatric surgeries. So in this, a large portion of the stomach, about 80%, is removed, creating a vertical sleeve that is banana-shaped. That sleeve holds about 1/10 of the preoperative stomach, and the there are no other anatomical changes involving the bowel. This procedure still results in decreased transit time in the small bowel, which can affect micronutrient absorption. And again, removal of the fundus of the stomach results in, again, increased production of GLP-1, which also contributes to weight loss. The removal of the stomach also results in reduction of ghrelin, which is a major appetite-stimulating hormone. So that also helps contribute to weight loss. With this, vitamin B12 and iron deficiencies are less likely, given that there is, you know, less change of the bowel and the small intestine with this procedure. And the average weight loss for this is about 25% to 30%. So maybe it's a slightly less than the Roux-en-Y, but still a significant amount. So both of these procedures are actually very safe. So perioperative mortality ranges from 0.2 to 0.4%, which is actually comparable to like a cholecystectomy. Roux-en-Y is a more complicated surgery than sleeve gastrectomy and does have a higher risk of short and long-term adverse events that can occur with that. But which of these procedures is superior for weight loss remains kind of an area of debate. There's been a lot of randomized controlled trials that have looked at this, and they have shown basically that there is greater weight loss and remission of diabetes with Roux-en-Y gastric bypass than with sleeve gastrectomy. But these differences may not really be clinically relevant. So
thank you, Dr. Lam. That is a really helpful review of those two, kind of the two predominant types of bariatric surgery. And I'd also direct the listeners that there's a nice figure in the didactic to kind of help put this together. I have found it helpful to literally draw it for my patients when they are wondering, because I think probably similar to your practice, we often do a lot of the talking up of the bariatric surgery, because most of our patients, at least in my experience, are not as enthusiastic as this patient in this case. So our next question for you are, what are some of the long-term benefits of bariatric surgery, which you've already started to allude to, and could we reasonably expect Mr. Z's diabetes to go into remission?
Yeah, so in regards to type 2 diabetes, the literature often defines diabetes remission as patients post-bariatric surgery with an A1C of 6 to 6.5% without medications. And in the vast majority of trials, the rate of remission of diabetes with bariatric surgery was shown to be significantly better than medical treatment. They showed improvement in the A1C by like 2 to 3.5%, and patients also had significant reduction in medication burden. So I think, yes, diabetes remission definitely possible and likely with bariatric surgery. Same for hypertension. Remission rates were like 43 to 83% after bariatric surgery in this big review that JAMA did. And so that is another thing that we can try to talk to patients about if they're really wanting to get off of a lot of their medications for blood pressure or diabetes. And then as we talked a little bit about the weight loss, is fairly significant. So, you know, 30 to 35% for Roux-en-Y at 1 year, 25 to 30% for sleeve gastrectomy. And then also in terms of overall mortality, bariatric surgery has been shown to have improvements in all-cause mortality as well, likely due to just lower death rates from diabetes, coronary artery disease, cancer, etc. So, and then finally, some of the other weight-related conditions, you know, in terms of hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, urinary incontinence, and reduced risk of all types of cancer and obesity-associated cancer all can be improved with bariatric surgery. So for Mr. Z, bariatric surgery will very likely improve his glycemic control and minimize his need for medications for both diabetes and hypertension, and his all-cause mortality is also likely to be lower after bariatric surgery. One thing to note is that we should be closely monitoring patients postoperatively for mood disorders and alcohol misuse, as there is some data suggesting higher rates of suicide accidents in bariatric surgery patients compared to non-surgical patients, as well as an increased risk of alcohol use disorder, possibly due to some impaired alcohol metabolism postoperatively.
Thank you, Dr. Lam. I'll say that improvement in mortality is very striking. Mm-hmm. There are very few interventions that we have in medicine that can achieve that. Just reducing risk of complications and death from all sorts of horrible diseases. So very profound and powerful. Our next question, which is kind of building on what are the other things we have to monitor for, are what are some of the short-term postoperative complications that can arise from bariatric surgery.
Yeah, so short term, again, as we talked about, there's overall a low 30-day mortality rate generally for, you know, both Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and sleeve gastrectomy. But the most common early complication for both is intra-abdominal bleeding, which occurs in 2-3% of patients. There can be anastomotic leaks, which is a very serious complication, however, that occurs quite rarely. Typically, patients present often with more like a sepsis picture, fever, abdominal pain, leukocytosis, and tachycardia. There can sometimes be stomal or anastomotic stenosis or strictures, which are usually seen 3 to 4 weeks after surgery. And for that, the presenting symptoms include nausea, vomiting, dysphagia, and a persistent feeling of fullness. Small bowel obstruction can also occur. Wound infection, venous thromboembolism can also occur with any surgical procedure. And then the most significant difference, I would say, between the Roux-en-Y and the sleeve gastrectomy are that since the sleeve gastrectomy, there really actually aren't any anastomoses. There usually isn't a risk of marginal ulcers or anastomotic leaking with that compared to the Roux-en-Y. As we noted before too, there's a lower risk of nutritional deficiencies usually with sleeve gastrectomy compared to the Roux-en-Y. However, sleeve gastrectomy does result in higher rates of GERD, while the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass actually improves GERD. And so that's often actually something that the surgeons are looking at. If a patient already has really significant GERD heartburn symptoms, that's often why they will opt for doing the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass over a sleeve gastrectomy in those patients.
That's very interesting. I did not know that. And I think it's just really helpful for us to know these short-term complications because potentially we might be seeing the patients or they might call us first, and then we need to know what's normal and what we need to do about these in terms of reconnecting with the surgical team. So let's get back to our case. You are able to answer Mr. Z's questions. He's very inspired. He is able to quit smoking and actually undergoes a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and loses 30% of his body weight. His diabetes is now well controlled, and he is no longer on any medications, and his A1C is down to 6.0. Similarly, his blood pressure has improved dramatically, and he's off his antihypertensive medications. He comes in for his annual exam, feeling great, of course, and this is 6 months after surgery. Now, as excellent internists, what monitoring do we need to make sure that he is getting, and how would you prevent and assess vitamin and mineral deficiencies?
So Mr. Z should be getting continued follow-up with his bariatric team, or at least a minimum with a registered dietitian who's experienced with bariatric surgery to improve his adherence with the post-surgical regimen and prevent weight regain and assess for micronutrient deficiencies. So this should occur at least yearly. I feel like I have a lot of patients who like really don't see their bariatric surgery team after they have bariatric surgery. So we should be encouraging them to follow up because that does actually help hopefully prevent the weight regain afterward. And then all patients who have undergone bariatric surgery should have lifelong vitamin supplementation to prevent deficiencies. So it's definitely something that we should be asking our patients about who have had bariatric surgery. There is on the G Drive, there is a helpful handout from the Virginia Mason Franciscan Health bariatric team that recommends different forms of vitamins and minerals, and they actually discourage gummy supplements, I guess, because they're not nutritionally enough complete. They also had like a little sample schedule in there, which was kind of nice because it actually showed that it was really just like 2 or 3 vitamins that were needed, especially if patients took like a combo bariatric multivitamin with iron and calcium supplementation. So it's not quite so onerous in terms of the number of pills that patients have to take. The severity and pattern of micronutrient deficiencies, again, depends on the type of procedure that was done. And so the two most common nutritional deficiencies post-gastric bypass are iron deficiency and B12 deficiency. These are often late complications seen months to years after bariatric surgery. And then, yeah, for iron deficiency, the iron needs an acidic environment to be converted to its absorbable form. And so in the Roux-en-Y, the stomach is smaller and produces less hydrochloric acid, which affects the ability for iron to be converted to this more soluble form. And so also with iron being mostly absorbed in the duodenum, this can create deficiencies, especially with the Roux-en-Y, where that is bypassed. Similarly, B12 also requires an acidic environment to be released from food. And so again, in patients with Roux-en-Y, gastric bypass, this process is altered. And so we need to supplement B12, especially in patients who have had Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And then calcium. Calcium is kind of affected in, I think, any of the bariatric surgeries. So it's typically absorbed in the duodenum and proximal jejunum. Similarly, also vitamin D absorption is also impaired with these procedures. So due to the potential for calcium and vitamin D deficiencies, we should also be thinking about DEXA monitoring actually more frequently than other patients. So approximately every 2 years for patients who have undergone bariatric surgery. I would say that I don't necessarily routinely remember this. And so a good thing to note for these patients. So as his PCP, you need to make sure, again, that he's adhering to his daily vitamin supplements. And you should also be aware of symptoms of micronutrient deficiencies and asking about them in the review of systems. Most common manifestations of the less obvious micronutrient deficiencies are neuropathies, dermatitis, or visual changes. There should be also some postoperative lab screening that we should do at least yearly, which again, there's a nice table that's in the didactic that's also from that same handout that I referenced, but generally should include a CBC, CMP, vitamin A, folate, iron studies, vitamin D, B12, and PTH with calcium, and then again remembering the DEXA scan approximately every 2 years. And then there's a bunch of other labs that you can do too, but some of those you may not necessarily need to do unless there are specific concerns or, you know, specific symptoms that a patient is exhibiting, including like selenium, copper, zinc testing. We would probably be doing lipids and A1C anyways as part of potentially an annual exam. So, and then again, for as his PCP, you will also just need to follow up on his comorbidities, potentially titrate down his medications or help him come off of his medications. You know, for Mr. Z, his hypertension and diabetes have resolved, and so helping him kind of taper off those medications. For like sleep apnea, could consider a repeat sleep study to reassess, you know, his CPAP requirements. And then, like I noted before, following his mood and being sensitive to any like psychosocial complications of bariatric surgeries is also important. So kind of screening for substance use, worsening depression, disordered eating, and offering support or referring to a psychologist if needed. So those are all the things as a primary care doctor we should be assessing in our post-bariatric surgery patients.
Thank you, Dr. Lam. That was a fantastic review. And these are, again, many things that will fall. Mm-hmm. Fall is the wrong word, but we are responsible for making sure get done. Because as you said, my experience has also been my patients don't necessarily see the bariatric team mm-hmm. as frequently as they are supposed to after their surgery. Mm-hmm. And so it is often up to us. And I will just share, I very recently, 2 weeks ago, had a bariatric patient of mine who had not been following up with bariatric surgery and mm-hmm. had an impressive iron deficiency mm-hmm. anemia. Mm-hmm. Very impressive. And that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I think we have a little bit of time to ask a couple more multiple choice questions.
Yeah.
So we can do some board practice. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So I'm going to give you just a couple questions and then multiple choice answers. So Mr. R is a 45-year-old man with a history of type 2 diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, knee osteoarthritis, and hypertension, who presents to your clinic for follow-up. His vitals today are notable for an elevated blood pressure of 148 over 90, and his height is 5'3", weight is 205 pounds, which I'm just going to save us all the trouble and tell you the BMI is 36. When discussing his weight trajectory, he reports trouble keeping his weight down consistently and trying various different diet plans over the years. He wants to know, again, is he eligible for bariatric surgery? So I'm going to give you a couple of answer choices, and I want you to tell us and explain to us which one is the best answer. A, he is eligible for bariatric surgery based on his BMI and the fact that he has obesity-related conditions. B, he is not eligible due to his low BMI and no obesity-related conditions. C, he is not eligible for bariatric surgery because he needs to try anti-obesity medications for a 6-month period. D, he is not eligible for bariatric surgery due to his high BMI. And E, He is eligible for bariatric surgery based on his BMI alone.
Yeah, so for this, the answer would be A. He is eligible for bariatric surgery based on his BMI and obesity-related conditions. His BMI is above 35, and with that, the class 2 obesity, we need obesity-related at least one obesity-related condition to qualify for bariatric surgery, which he definitely has because he has type 2 diabetes and sleep apnea and knee osteoarthritis and hypertension. But yes, he is eligible for bariatric surgery.
Excellent. Okay, we're going to do another question. Mrs. D is a 42-year-old woman with a history of type 2 diabetes, class 3 obesity, hyperlipidemia, and hypertension, who comes into your office for management of her chronic medical conditions. She had gastric bypass surgery 2 years ago. She no longer sees her bariatric surgery team because they're out of state. And of course, you're their PCP, so from her standpoint, what else does she need? What test is recommended for the patient at this time? And so our answer choices. A, colonoscopy. B, echocardiogram. C, bone density test. D, fit DNA test. And E, an EKG.
Yes. So for this, the answer would be C, bone density. As we talked about, that is recommended approximately every 2 years after all bariatric procedures. Bone loss is estimated to be about 5%, but post-bariatric surgery, and there's just that decrease of calcium and vitamin D absorption that results in bone loss. So we should be thinking about more frequent DEXAs in this population of patients.
And we have one more question for you. Mrs. ME is a 40-year-old woman with a history of type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and a history of Roux-en-Y, who presents to your primary care office reporting feeling very tired for the past 3 months. Her vitals today are reassuringly normal. Her BMI is 30, which is down from 45 prior to surgery. Her hemoglobin A1C is at goal. However, her hemoglobin is 9 with an MCV of 80. Other blood work is unremarkable. Her medications include metformin 500 a day and rosuvastatin 5 milligrams at night. So, given what we've been told, what is the most likely diagnosis for this patient? Answer choice A, iron deficiency anemia. Answer choice B, vitamin B12 deficiency. Answer choice C, vitamin K deficiency. Answer choice D, hypocalcemia. And answer choice E, hypokalemia.
Yes. So for this patient, the answer would be A, iron deficiency anemia. Given her history of gastric bypass and she's not taking any of her vitamins or supplements, it's likely she hasn't been taking any iron. And so she has anemic with like borderline low MCV. So this is most consistent with iron deficiency anemia.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Lam, for walking us through all of this. Again, it's an underutilized surgery and resource and has really profound impacts on patients' lives. And there's some counseling they need to know going into it. And then there's a lot of important monitoring afterwards, but very safe surgery, very efficacious between the two most common forms of bariatric surgery. Any other words for our listeners today?
I don't think so. Yeah, like I said, I think it's a very common thing that we see either patients who are thinking about bariatric surgery and or have had one. And so hopefully this gives some helpful tips to follow for monitoring as well as sort of deciding if patients qualify for the surgery.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to having everybody join us next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.